Rob Schoenman.
And Maya Schoen. We're glad to be back with you after the WBAI Fund Drive. Thanks to all of you who contributed and keep this valuable station on the air. Our program today, The Specter of Military Dictatorship. Here we are again, next stage, and we are going to have a call-in show today. We'll be speaking about some of the latest information on this subject, and then we'd like to take your calls and comments and interact as we enter into the close of the year and this 2 weeks of holidays. 212-209-2900 is the number to call when we are ready to take your calls. Again, 212-209-2900. First, I'd like to begin with an article that appeared in the Army Times. Just disconnected us, Ralph.
Hello? Maya? Ralph? Oh, well, that is live radio at times. And look like I gotta get them back up. While that happens, why don't you just take and listen to this?
Sorry for that interruption, where, as you can tell, we're speaking to you from California, and we had a slight interruption here at our end. Again, addressing the Army Times, an article that appeared September 30th, 2008, that shocked those of us here, because it was quite unexpected. Brigade Homeland tours start October 1st. The 3rd Infantry's 1st BCT trains for a new dwell time mission. And this is just Army speak, but what it actually is talking about is the 3rd Infantry Division's 1st Brigade Combat Team, which has spent 35 of the last 60 months in Iraq patrolling in full battle gear, is now training for the same mission, these are the words of the Army Times, with a twist at home. Beginning October 1st, that's October 1st of 2008, and for the next 12 months, the 1st Brigade Combat Team will be under the day-to-day control of the U.S. Army North. That's the Army Service Component, NORTHCOM, and it's an on-call federal response force for natural or man-made emergencies and disasters, including so-called terrorist attacks. It's not the first time an active-duty unit has been tapped to help at home. In August 2005, for example, when Hurricane Katrina unleashed hell in Mississippi, writes the Army Times, and in Louisiana, several active-duty units were pulled from various posts and mobilized to those areas. But, notes the Army Times, this new mission marks the first time that an active unit has been given a dedicated assignment to NORTHCOM, a joint command established in 2002. Think about this. The command, that's NORTHCOM, is based in Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado Springs, Colorado. But the 1st BCT, which returned in April after 15 months in its last tour of duty in Iraq, is going to operate out of its home post in Fort Stewart, Georgia. And what is it going to be doing? It's not really natural disasters. It is training with the first ever non-lethal package that the Army has fielded. That is, what they call non-lethal package includes equipment to stand up a hasty roadblock, spike strips for slowing, stopping, or controlling traffic, shields and batons, beanbag bullets, and tasers. Ralph?
We're calling this program, brothers and sisters, The Specter of Military Dictatorship. This is not rhetoric. The Army Times continues that as the first BCT finishes its dwell-time mission, expectations are that this active duty brigade will take over and that the mission will be a permanent one. The particulars are very instructive. They will learn new skills, some of those they acquired in the war zone, and this time they hope they will not be shot at while doing it. They will be called upon to help put down civil unrest, crowd control, to deal with potential horrific scenarios such as massive poisoning and chaos in response to chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, high-yield explosives, or CBRNE attacks. Training for the homeland scenario has already begun at Fort Stewart. It includes specialty tasks, such as knowing how to use the so-called jaws of life to extract people from mangled vehicles, extra training for a CBRNE incident, working with forestry experts to go in with chainsaws and clear roads. The soldiers will learn how to use the first ever non-lethal package, quote-unquote, that the Army has fielded. The commander, Colonel Ralph Roger Cloutier, stated, referring to crowd and each traffic equipment control and weapons designed to subdue unruly or dangerous individuals. The package is for use in war zone operations. It's a new modular package of non-lethal capabilities that they're fielding. They've used it in Iraq, but this is the first time that these modules have been consolidated, the package fielded, and the mission designed for, quote, at home, unquote. I am not a small guy, said Cloutier. I was the first guy in the brigade to get tasered. He described the experience as your worst muscle cramp ever, 10 times throughout your whole body. I weigh 230 pounds. It put me on my knees in seconds. This is a very detailed article, brothers and sisters, in the Army Times, delineating a permanent mission for the for U.S. combat forces in U.S. cities. And the further articulation of these articles, as we will discuss in the course of this show, anticipates demonstrations, civil unrest, strikes, opposition to governmental policies, in short, the imposition of a military dictatorship in the U.S.
Glenn Greenwald in Salon.com refers to this article that appeared in the Army Times with, on September 24th, why is a U.S. Army brigade being assigned to the homeland? And Greenwald refers back to the changes that took place in the Posse Comitatus, that is, with the 2007 Defense Appropriations Act, 2006, the Defense Authorization Act of 2006. Because in that act, which was reported so well by Frank Morales, the President George Bush was given the power to impose martial law in the event of a, quote, terrorist incident, or if he or other federal officials perceived a shortfall of, quote, public order, or even in response to anti-war protests that got so-called unruly as a result of government provocations. In just a few paragraphs, in that $500 billion Defense Authorization Act of 2006, it overturned what had been the Insurrection Act of 1807, which severely restricted the president's ability to deploy the military within the United States. And there was a loophole in the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878, which had tightened even the restrictions of the Insurrection Act. And the loophole was that Posse Comitatus is waived if the president invokes the Insurrection Act. In other words, if he believes the country is at risk of an insurrection. The John Warner National Defense Act for 2007 changed the name of the provision in the statute book from Insurrection Act to, quote, Enforcement of the Laws to Restore Public Order Act. And this was very important because the law then expanded to include natural disaster, epidemics, or other serious public health emergencies, terrorist acts or incidents, or the vague term other condition. And other condition was not defined or limited. Thus, Section 1076 became law and expanded how government power could be used at the whim of the president to use the military directly within the United States. Ralph.
Well, we must remember that in New Orleans, it was precisely these pretexts which led to the declaration of martial law and 70,000 troops assigned in what was called Operation Somalia by the Army Times at the time. And indeed, it included the unleashing of Blackwater in similar numbers, so that you had a virtual army of occupation in New Orleans operating under conditions of martial law. Section 1076 of the John Warner National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2007 changed the name of the key provision in the statute book from Insurrection Act to Enforcement of the Laws to Restore Public Order. In short, as you were mentioning, Maya, this is the apparatus for martial law. Now, this has been noted and expanded upon by a number of interesting figures, including the conservative James Bovard, who wrote in the American Conservative on April 23rd, 2007, working for the clampdown, what the president may do with his new power to declare martial law. And he writes, "How many pipe bombs will it take to end American democracy? Far fewer than it would have taken a year ago. The Defense Authorization Act of 2006, passed on September 30th, empowers George Bush to impose martial law in the event of a, quote, terrorist incident, unquote, if he or other federal officials perceive a shortfall of public order, or in response to anti-war protests that get unruly as a result of government provocation. The media, and most of Capitol Hill," James Bovard writes in the American Conservative, "ignored or cheered on this grant of nearly boundless power. But now that the president's arsenal of authority is swollen and consecrated, a few voices of complaint are heard here and there. Even the New York Times recently condemned a new law for, quote, making martial law easier, unquote," writes Bovard. "It took a few paragraphs in a $500 billion, 591-page bill to raise one of the most important limits on federal power. Congress passed the Insurrection Act in 1807 to restrict severely the president's ability to deploy the military within the United States. The Posse Comitatus Act of 1878 tightened these restrictions, imposing a 2-year prison sentence on anyone who used the military within the U.S. without express permission of Congress. But there is a loophole. Posse Comitatus is waived if the president invokes the Insurrection Act. And as Bovard notes what others have noted before him, he indicates as follows. The Katrina debacle drowned in Washington's resistance to military rule. Bush declared, I want there to be robust discussion about the best way for the federal government to rally assets for the good of the people. There was no robust discussion, says Bovard. The administration upped the ante, labeling the breach levies, quote, the equivalent of a weapon of mass destruction used on the city of New Orleans. Section 1076, supported by conservatives and liberals, Bovard writes, Senator Carl Levin, the Democrat from Michigan, the ranking Democratic member on the Senate Armed Services Committee, co-wrote the provision, along with Chairman John Warner of the Republican of Virginia. Senator Ted Kennedy openly endorsed it, and Representative Duncan Hunter of California, chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, was an avid proponent. Now, it's interesting to note that every governor in the country opposed these changes and loudly objected. Senator Patrick Leahy, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, warned, we certainly do not want to make it easier for the president to declare martial law, but that is what is happening. And he said it 10 days later in the Congressional Record, using the military for law enforcement goes against one of the founding tenets of our democracy. He warned, we are in the presence of imminent martial law.
Now, Ralph, we have been reporting this, and we did the reporting contemporaneously, and as you recall, we also did a very important event with Frank Morales on just the issue of is martial law on the agenda, which became a WBAI premium. And you rightly note that the governors felt that this was a usurpation of their authority because governors are in charge of the National Guard in each state. As a result, you have to remember that there was bipartisan support for this, as you noted. But in 2008, the National Defense Authorization Act, in response to all the objections that were being raised, somewhat limited the scope of the powers, but it's only somewhat. And it was limited by saying that the president was limited, in other words, overturning the Insurrection Act, to deploy the military to suppress disorder that threatens constitutional rights. It's still vague. But President Bush, when he signed the 2000 Act into law, issued a signing statement. These are these hundreds and hundreds of signing statements that the president issues to show how he views the limitation of the congressional law. And in his signing statement, he seemed to declare that he would not recognize those limitations. And what we have here is we going into the new Obama administration is the military already allocating troops within the United States. Because although NORTHCOM was set up, NORTHCOM did not have any specific troops under its command. And now the Army is setting up 20,000 troops, and it's going to be a permanent shift, according to the Army Times, here already in the United States, and it opens up for more troops directly involved in U.S. policy. Ralph.
The Washington Post carried a very important article, brothers and sisters, by Thomas Schweik on December 21st, 2008. That's 2 days ago. Quote, and this is the headline, "The Pentagon is muscling in everywhere. It's time to stop the mission creep. We no longer have a civilian-led government. It is hard for me, a lifelong Republican and son of a retired Air Force colonel, to say it. But the most unnerving legacy of this Bush administration is the encroachment of the Department of Defense in a striking number of aspects of civilian government. Our Constitution is now at risk. Barack Obama's selections of James L. Jones, a retired four-star Marine general, to be his national security advisor, and retired Naval Admiral Dennis C. Blair to be his director of national intelligence, presents the incoming administration with an important opportunity, but a major risk. These appointments pave the way for respected military officers potentially to reverse the trend of Pentagon encroachment, or they may, in fact, complete the silent military coup d'etat, steadily gaining ground below the radar screen of most Americans and the media." And this important article by this son of a retired Air Force colonel and a Republican figure, Thomas Schweik, is very explicit. The White House, which let the Defense Department call the budgetary shots, vastly underfunded efforts by the State Department and the Justice Department and the USAID to train civilian police forces, has now allocated funds and given a primary role to the military in every aspect of American policy and institutional life.
Ralph, Thomas A. Schweik served in the Bush administration as the ambassador for counter-narcotics in Afghanistan as part of the State Department, and in that position he saw the work of the State Department being preempted by the military in Afghanistan, and he also served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Law Enforcement Affairs. And in that role, he again has seen the military preempting what he considers should be the role of the State Department. And in this piece that he wrote for the Washington Post and has been commented on extensively, and he also did an outlook, a discussion session with responding to questions on the Washington Post on December 22nd. That's also very interesting to read. He goes through different areas of the government where the military has preempted the work of the civilian agencies, whether it's the CIA or whether it's the State Department or the Drug Enforcement Agency. I recommend that everyone go and read Thomas A. Schweik's article, his opinion piece in the Washington Post, "The Pentagon is Muscling in Everywhere, It's Time to Stop the Mission Creep." That's December 21st of the Washington Post online. Ralph.
He writes, the result of letting the Pentagon take thorough charge of programs to create local police forces has been unnecessarily militarized. It's producing police officers who look like militia members, not ordinary beat cops. These forces now risk becoming paramilitary groups, well-armed with U.S. equipment. And he writes, as military officers seek to take over the role played by civilian development experts, the Pentagon bureaucrats have quietly populated the National Security Council and the State Department with their own particular personnel, retired officers, officers on detail from the Pentagon, to ensure that the Defense Department keeps an eye on other agencies. And he writes, indeed, the Pentagon has drawn up plans to deploy 20,000 U.S. soldiers inside our borders by 2011, ostensibly to help state and local officials respond to attacks or catastrophes. But that mission will spill over from emergency work into border patrol effects, intelligence gathering, law enforcement operations. It runs smack into the Posse Comitatus Act, he writes. And he says the generals are not only dominating our government activities abroad and at our borders, but they are intent to spread out across the heartland of America. That is Thomas Schweik on December 21st, 2008, in the Washington Post. And here, indeed, in the Army Times, Gina Cavallaro amplifies what Schweik warns against. A final mission rehearsal exercise is scheduled at Fort Stewart. It will be run by the Joint Task Force Civil Support, a unit based out of Fort Monroe. It will coordinate and evaluate inter-service events. In addition, the 1st BCT and other Army units will take part in training exercises, including elements of the 1st Brigade out of Fort Hood, Texas, and the 82nd Combat Aviation Brigade from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. There will be Air Force engineer units, a Marine Corps Chemical Biological Initial Reaction Force, a Navy team, and members of the Defense Logistics Agency and the Defense Threat Reduction Agency. One of the things Volkler said they'll be looking at is communications capabilities between the services. It is a concern, and we're checking that. And one of the ways we do that is by having these exercises we are rehearsing and setting up a communication system to make sure we have interoperability. I don't know what America's overall plan is. I know that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines are standing by to come into the U.S. and help, Cloutier said. Quote, it makes me feel good as an American to know that our country has dedicated forces to come in and help at home, unquote. That's the Army Times. The Brigade Homeland Tours start October 1st. Now, what's instructive here, as the World Socialist website states very prophetically and ominously, in today's article on December 23rd, Obama, the military, and the threat of dictatorship. With his choice of Admiral Dennis Blair as Director of National Intelligence, Barack Obama has now named three recently retired four-star military officers to serve in his cabinet. This unprecedented representation of the senior officer corps within the incoming Democratic administration is indicative of the growth of the political power of the United States military, and it poses a direct and serious threat to basic democratic rights. As the head of U.S. military's Pacific Command in 1999 to 2000, Blair, Admiral Dennis Blair, was distinguished by his solidarizing with the Pentagon and the military of Indonesia in carrying out butchery in East Timor, vetoing the half-hearted human rights concerns spoken of by the Clinton administration. Before tapping Blair, Obama named Marine General James Jones as National Security Advisor and former Army Chief of Staff General Eric Shinseki as Secretary of Veterans Affairs. And the incoming administration will ask retired Air Force General Michael Hayden to stay on as Director of Central Intelligence. The Washington Post described this concentration of senior officers in the administration, quote, as an unusual trend for a Democratic administration that has surprised both political camps, unquote. Now, this article in the World Socialist website is quite lengthy, And it summarizes some of the material that we have been doing on Taking Aim, brothers and sisters, for the past 6 and 7 years. And it goes on. There is a more fundamental process underlying Obama's bowing before the military. It is the immense growth of the power of the military-industrial complex against which Dwight Eisenhower warned nearly half a century ago, but a power that has grown uninterruptedly during the last 7 years of the so-called global war on terrorism. This expansion of power, together with the rise in the military funding, has escalated, accompanied by sinister features bound up with U.S. imperialism's reliance on militarism to offset the decline in its global economic position. The military chiefs of the Pentagon's regional commands, CENTCOM, PACCOM, SOUTHCOM, and now the new AFRICOM, have supplanted ambassadors and civilian officials as the representatives of U.S. interests and power around the globe.
Well,
yes, ma'am.
Before we go to our listeners and have people call in, I want to refer back to the Thomas Schweik article, because in it, he talks about seeding the various supposedly civilian offices, and he said Pentagon bureaucrats quietly populated the National Security Council and the State Department with their own personnel, some civilians, some consultants, some retired officers, some offices on, quote, detail, end quote, from the Pentagon, to ensure that the Defense Department could keep an eye on its rival agencies. And he also mentions that, for instance, the first director of national intelligence, John Negroponte, who had been a State Department official, who eventually gave up his post, and Mike McConnell, a former Navy admiral, took over, and then again Michael V. Hayden, who was a four-star Air Force general, became the director of the CIA, and the national security advisor, Stephen J. Hadley, saw much of the responsibility for developing and implementing policy on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan turned over to Lieutenant General Douglas E. Lute, who was Bush's new, quote, war czar. So that's from the Thomas Schweik article, where he talks about the Pentagon muscling in everywhere. And remember, this is coming from a lifelong Republican.
Maya, let me just mention this here, and I know we're going to go to the calls momentarily. A report appeared in a magazine published by the United States Army War College last month, indicating that the Pentagon is preparing its own transition, a process driven not by Obama's, as the World Socialist website calls it, vague promise of change, but by what the military command sees as a historic crisis of the existing order requiring the use of armed force to quell social struggles at home. Now, we were going to do this program originally today, brothers and sisters, on the auto industry bailout and the crisis of the trade union movement with the total capitulation of the trade union bureaucracy of the UAW and the virtual annihilation of the UAW as a vehicle for defending workers' union rights, union wages, union benefits, union pensions, indeed representation of any kind. But the immediacy of this issue of martial law led us to address this question today, but the context is just that, the crisis of U.S. capitalism, the terminal crisis of U.S. capitalism, and the incipient uprising of the American people, of which there are indicators all across this country at every sector.
We pause now for our station ID.
This is Phil Donahue. I have 600 channels in my home, but 400 of them are selling the Bowflex machine. That's why I listen to WBAI New York.
I love words. I thank you for hearing my words. I want to tell you something about words that I think is important.
The most important thing that we can do right now is to re-engage the American people.
Really? Yeah. There are 400,000 words in the English language, and there are 7 of them you can't say on television.
Don't tell me words don't matter.
What a ratio that is.
I have a dream. Just words. We hold these truths to be self-evident. believe all men are created equal, just words. We have nothing to fear but fear itself, just words. Just speeches, just words.
As I say, they're my work, they're my play, they're my passion. Words are all we have, really.
Don't tell me words don't matter.
It's 2008.
There are no shortcuts.
Are you kidding me?
Tune in. 11 p.m. New Year's Eve. Right here on WBAI FM.
Shortcuts.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We return now to the second portion of today's program, The Specter of Military Dictatorship. We're ready to take your calls, 212-209-2900. And our great, we'll start with our first. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
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 Thanks for calling.
Yes, this is Stefan Omar calling from the village of Harlem. How are you?
How are you doing?
Okay, first of all, I want to wish everyone a happy Kwanzaa, happy Christmas, and whatever else you're celebrating, just be safe and be warm. And, you know, what I'm listening to is frightening. It's scary. My question to you is this. First of all, President-elect Barack Obama is not in office now, as we know. And you have people who want to impeach him, and he's still a senator. But, you know, I would say that, you know, Is it fair that we give him a chance to try and turn this mess around? Because Cheney Bush, or I call him Guantanamo George, has really messed this whole system up. Can't we just give the brother a chance to get in and try and straighten this thing out? I mean, even though he's appointed these people to these different positions, they can get fired too, you know. I mean, nothing is etched in stone. And, you know, it's scary that through all of this.
Look, brother, I appreciate your call, but I think the question is not quite rightly placed. The issue is to give us a chance, to give working people a chance, to give the oppressed a chance. We don't need to give Barack Obama a chance to appoint people slightly to the right of Genghis Khan. There is no important position which has not been assigned to war criminals. Gates, his Secretary of Defense, is famous for his role in the Iran-Contra in the October surprise. There is no prior president from Reagan to Bush Sr. to Bush Jr. not served by this array of people that have been put into place by Barack Obama. Here's the piece by Dana Priest in the Washington Post on December 20th. Pick for Intel Chief Signals Shift. No-nonsense retired admiral is the third four-star officer named to a top post by Obama. This is not just any officer. Dennis Blair's assignment as military liaison to the CIA 13 years ago entailed overseeing the slaughter in East Timor, the massacre of the population that the Indonesian military had been subjugating under the direction of the United States. Secret agendas, as the Washington Post writes, has never been Denny Blair's style. The four-star admiral is in your face with what he wants to do. There are 16 other intelligence officers. This is not an administration that is creating change. This is an administration that is consolidating the whole hold of war criminals and the most vicious exploiters of working people within this apparatus of control that Barack Obama will oversee and legitimize. We don't need to give him a chance. He needs to give us a chance to survive the system in terminal decay, brother.
Well, to overturn the system in terminal decay, because that would be, if he were really on our side, that would be his role as a social activist, not as an instrument of Wall Street. And our next caller... Hello, you're on the air
yes.
with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen.
Yes, how you doing? My name is Shahid from Nassau County, and I have to agree with the both of you about the military dictatorship. And, you know, the Indians must be on the reservation right now thinking that the American people are heavily sedated with firewater or something, not to see the military dominance that the elite is trying to force on this planet. Now, I agree with you that not to give Obama a chance. I mean, Obama is just who he is. He's a chance for change. But he's not going to help change anything if the American people don't support him. If the American people don't support Obama, and when I say support Obama, I mean support the change that Obama campaigned for, there's not going to be any change because he's going to be subservient to the banking cartels that are investing American taxpayers' dollars into military dominance. And being that he's a 32nd-degree Mason, his allegiance is not going to be to the American people. It's going to be to his fraternity unless the American people rise up and fight against these secret societies that are paying these politicians to do what they're doing.
Brother, thank you for that, but I would like to make a particular point. It's not a matter of the 32nd-degree Masons or secret societies. It's a matter of the 1% of the population that owns and controls more than 95% of the national wealth of the United States, more than the rest of us do combined. 1 week before the election, as I've mentioned before on Taking Aim, Clinton and Obama appeared on a platform, two platforms actually, in Florida, in particular in Orlando. It was at the time
by
of the
Clinton, you're speaking of former President Bill Clinton.
Yes, I mean former President Bill Clinton.
Not the current, Secretary of State.
Not the Secretary of State who's expanding the role of the Secretary of State's office to maintain a complete apparatus of her own. No, not that particular Clinton. Clinton, in the last part of his speech, said the following. It was right at the time of the financial a bailout, trillions of dollars, over $7 trillion that were handed without any conditions, without any knowledge as to what it would be used for, who it was going to, and Clinton said the following. I want to show you and tell you just how reliable Barack is, and I hope he won't be mad at me 1 week before the election for saying this. He said, but when we were confronted by the economic crisis that we have now, Barack called Paul Volcker, Henry Paulson, Warren Buffett, Robert Rubin, Thomas Geithner, and me. And he said, you tell me what to do and I'll sell it. And then Clinton gave a big grin as if to say, he's ours, he's not yours. That's what Barack Obama represents. As we said in our prior programs, not a dime's worth of difference. So we don't need to give support to the brother. We need to give support to our struggle. We need to support the workers in UE in Chicago who occupied that factory. We need to support the fight back of the auto workers who are going to be out of a union job without union wages, who are being, by Democrats and Republicans alike, driven to have wages equal to non-union wages of foreign auto companies in the southern states. We need a struggle against the oppression, the exploitation that the deepening crisis of capital means. It will dwarf the Great Depression. It will mean unemployment. It will mean hunger. It will mean desperation for huge sections of our people. That's what the domestic application of military rule and the role of the military in our society is designed to suppress. That's what the crisis of capitalism leads to. This is the architecture of the fascist state, brother. That's what we have to fight against. We need to support ourselves in our resistance to this criminal system.
Our next caller, please.
Hi, this is Mark Bilk, your web administrator. How you doing?
Good to talk to you, Mark. Thanks for calling.
Once again, Ralph, I want to urge you to start a new political party, run for president, because you are the best person I've ever heard talking about what needs to be done and the way things are. However, the immediate reason why I called up is to talk about one of the weapons that these army troops may use against crowds or unruly anti-war demonstrators, and that is called the active denial system. Now, this is not a new mode of propaganda. What this is a microwave cannon or electromagnetic ray gun, which shoots a very powerful beam of high-frequency microwaves hundreds of feet, I think half a mile or so. And the thing is, these are high-frequency microwaves, 95 gigahertz, instead of the usual microwave oven frequency of 2.5 gigahertz. And they will supposedly penetrate only the very outer layer of skin, 1/64th of an inch. But they can burn that layer of skin right off you and also curdle the corneas of your eyes like hard-boiled eggs. Now, there will be intensity. There are intensity controls on this device, which, are intended to be set by the soldiers there who are firing it, depending on how far away the people are that they're frying with this thing, so that it supposedly will just cause them pain instead of injuring or killing them, you know, causing third-degree burns or blinding them permanently. But, you know, how well can we trust the soldiers to set these intensity controls correctly? Now, any type of electromagnetic radiation, its intensity weakens as the square of the distance from the emitter, which means that if a person is, 200 feet away instead of 2,000 feet away, and the thing is set for 2,000 feet to, heat somebody so that they'll run away at 2,000 feet, At 200 feet, it's going to be 100 times as intense, and so it's going to cause third degree burns and permanent blindness.
Mark, thanks for calling in with this information. It sounds like it's even stronger than the People Zapper, which we reported about many years ago.
Yes, but I want to say this, Mark, that these microwave-style weapons have been actually tested out and used in Iraq and in Afghanistan, particularly in Iraq. But I think our concerns here are, after all, at the time of the war in Vietnam, when the people of Vietnam were subjected to saturation bombing, the most fiendish weapons were deployed, gases that exploded the pupil of the eye. Millions of people were affected across Vietnam by this absolutely unspeakable war of atrocity. And we can, of course, assume that weapons of this kind will be in the arsenal of the military for our own population, as they have been for others. Indeed, they have used biological agents on the American people. We've discussed this in the discussion of an 8-part series on the engendering the next pandemic, and on the book by, what's the name of the book, Meyer?
Clouds of Secrecy.
Clouds of Secrecy, thank you. It documents 40 years of the Pentagon deploying biological agents that trillions of bacilli release in the subway system of New York and in the school systems of St. Louis and Minneapolis and throughout the Bay Area of the San Francisco region, which led to a 10 times increase in spinal and brain meningitis. No. There's no limit to the fiendish types of weaponry that will be deployed against masses of people. But our concerns here is not with the specific weaponry, although it's very important to alert people to this this horror. And as you do that, and Mark, and as you document it, it radicalizes people. It forces upon them an awareness of the malevolence of this system, which is in terminal decay. I want to mention that in the article in today's World Socialist website, Obama, the Military, and the Threat of Dictatorship, it not only cites the Washington Post articles that we've mentioned here by Thomas Schweitzer and by the American conservative author, but it references, as Dana Priest does in the Washington Post, a very important study called Known Unknown: Unconventional Strategic Shocks in Defense Strategy Development by Nathan Fryer, which goes into the plans for military occupation across the United States and discusses the sorts of weapons that you are mentioning, Mark,
What's more important in my judgment, or most important, is that the Strategic Studies Institute study of November 2008 by Nathan Fryer, and I would ask our readers to go to Google and take it down. It's about 45 pages, Known Unknowns, Unconventional Strategic Shocks in Defense Strategy Development. Is very specific about how this apparatus is to be applied in the U.S. And there's a foreword by U.S. Army Colonel John A. Cardos and by the director of the Strategic Studies Institute, Douglas C. Lovelace, Jr. This is being openly fleshed out by the highest level of planning authority in the Pentagon and in the military.
Okay, thanks for calling, Mark. We're our next caller, please.
Hello.
Hello, yes. You're on the air with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my phone call. This is Zach from People's Republic of Astoria. I appreciate every second when I listen to you every week. You are the best. And as far as Barack Obama counts, he's the same person with different clothing. It's a continuation of George Bush. Have a good night, and may the Mother Nature be on your side all the time.
Thank you,
brother. We really appreciate that. We're so happy to hear from you. I think it's important that people do understand that it isn't a question here, as I like to quote Malcolm X as saying, it's not about a black face in a high place. And the role of the Democratic Party and the role of the black bourgeoisie in bondage to the ruling class and its apparatus, whether they are the so-called poverty pimps who cashed in on Johnson's apparatus of control, or liberal figures like Wilson Good, who was the mayor of Philadelphia, who succeeded Frank Rizzo, he required a liberal black mayor in office in Philadelphia after the specter of Frank Rizzo and his in-your-face racist butcher cops. It took a Good in office in Philadelphia to allow for the bombing of MOVE, for taking a whole section of Philadelphia and bombing it from the air. That I mention that because the expectations and the illusions about figures like whether it's Barack Obama or Wilson Good or any number of figures who serve this role, who are instruments of administration for a system that oppresses and exploits us and has does not have our interests at heart, obviously, that we have to be clear. The question is the role that these people play, whose interests they serve, what they do. Nobody who had any remote interest in resisting the oppression of this system would create an apparatus of administration like Barack Obama has done. Every single individual who was surrounding him, who was put into administrative control, the apparatus, is in continuity with all the preceding military and intelligence
and financial
oppressors of our population, and above all, oppressors of the African-American population, the most overwhelmingly exploited sector of the working class in the United States. We did a whole series on Barack Obama, Not a Dime's Worth of Difference, False Hope and Short Change, and in doing so, we sought to document how he came into political play, who funded him, Archer Daniels Midland, his service to ethanol, which entails, by the way, in the Cote d'Ivoire in the west of Africa, the actual enslavement of African farmers and peasants. We have to be clear about the class role that figures like this play and not be taken in by the soft soap rhetoric, which is designed to put us to sleep, to contain us.
We have time for one last call. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, good evening. My name is Ed from South Jamaica. How you doing?
How you doing? Thanks for calling,
yeah,
brother.
I tend to agree with you as far as dealing with Barack Obama. I listened to your series, and I've done research on him myself, his connections to big business and Arthur Daniels Midland. And I personally am one to say that anything that comes out of this capitalist system, no matter whether it be black, blue, yellow, green, is going to be corrupt because the nature of the system is corrupt. It was founded in corruption. It's steeped in corruption. If you study history, it's all through it. It radiates through it. Oppression, corruption is designed. By its design, you're going to be corrupt if you try to work within it. But what I'm saying is that, and don't take this the wrong way, I've heard people like you talk, but you don't give any real-time solutions. How can we fight this system? Because this system is large, and sometimes it can tend to be overwhelming. Even the little bit of hope that people felt with the election of Barack Obama or the selection of Barack Obama by the corporate powers that be, the little bit of hope, sometimes you crush it. You know, that whole series was a good series, but I know a lot of people that were offended by it because they thought that this was something that was going to help us, especially in the black community, of which I am a member. And I just want some real-time ideas because I agree with you on some things, but there's got to be a ray of hope somewhere in this mess.
Well, brother, I thank you for that. And, of course, the issue is what is to be done?
And, Ralph, we've thought long and hard, and in 2009 we're going to do an entire series on
Yes, but I want to mention to you, brother, the following. There is a long history of struggle in the United States involving political organization and political parties outside of the framework of capitalist politics. We are not condemned to be confined to the Republican and Democratic parties. There have been working class parties. There have been black parties. There have been socialist parties. There have been farm mobilizations, worker mobilizations. We have before us a huge opportunity because the mass of our people are hurting. And their terrible condition of oppression, of unemployment, of short-circuiting their ability to survive will get worse. This system cannot sustain itself. The bailouts, the trillions of dollars that are being handed out to these criminals, these gangsters, will not do a damn thing except create an even greater crisis. And that's what these preparations for martial law are about. Working people feel that, experience it, they know it. The question that you're raising is the right question. What is to be done? As Rosa Luxemburg put it, in the beginning was the deed. Well, let's get it together, brothers and sisters. We have the possibilities, the capacities to build a workers' party in the United States, a mass party in the United States. In every state, in every location, we have to break with the two parties of capital. We have to call the system by its name, not this liberal twaddle about deep politics, but about capitalist politics, about class politics. We have to reclaim the ideological capital that is ours. We have to restore the notion of a socialist alternative to capitalism, of a democratic working class mass party for socialist transformation of a rotten capitalist order. That is available to us in every location around every concrete struggle, and that's the song of the future. We all have to, as the brother says, concentrate on what is to be done and the organizational process of getting it done. It's a big task. It's the task of the future. The more they oppress us, the more they expose who they are.
It's the task of the present.
It's the task of the present as well as of the future. I agree with you, Mike. Very much the task of the present. But the point again here, brother, is that there's no reason for us to feel the inability to fight back. It's in our hands to do just that. Let's get to it.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoen
and Maya Schoen. Thanks to all of the callers who made it on the air today, and thanks to all of you who tried. We'll be doing more call-in shows in the coming year. The program today, The Specter of Military Dictatorship, will be on the Taking Aim website, thanks to Mark Filk, one of our callers today, our valiant webmaster. And that is at www.takingaimradio.com.
And we will take up the message of our listeners and our callers to concentrate on how we begin to organize the fight back. That's where it's at. I agree with you.
You can contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net. That's PACBELL.net. We'll be with you next week.
Little girl, why are you so sad? It's almost time for Christmas.